Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to The High-Low, the weekly current affairs and pop culture podcast brought to you by Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes. How was Hey Dolly? There's one talk from there that's gone viral, which we're going to talk about later.
Mine. Hey was heaven. I had such a good time. I was interviewed by Clemency Burton Hill, who is just the most brilliant, skillful interviewer. So I just really, really loved our event, and the audience was lovely. And also, it was so nice doing Hey this year with the book having taken on a bit of a life, because last year I did it, the book was quite new. So the majority of the audience were like basically men in barbers who had like an hour to kill before Simon Sharma, who just had no idea who I was. So I just felt like the audience were more responsive and more kind of understanding of where I'm coming from. Which was really, really enjoyable. I really liked it. Had a cup of tea and a gossip with Fortunately's Fee and Jane, which was basically a dream come true. I actually, when I was in the middle of talking with them, I was thinking, if I were at like a charity dinner and this came up as like a prize in a charity auction, I would have bid up to £150 for it. And there I was, just eating lemon drizzle cake for free, doing it in the green room. It was great. They were lovely. I also had a hilarious encounter with Philippe Sands.
Sexiest voice ever.
So Pandora and I recommended a Radio 4 programme he did a few months ago called The Rat Line, which was brilliant and very, very interesting, about Nazis escaping out of Germany post-war. But the thing that Pandora and I also noticed in his show is that he has this very, very seductive voice. Clemmy, when I arrived in the green room, said, "Oh, I've got someone that you have to meet." And she took me over to this man and was like, "This is Dolly from The High-Low. She and Pandora are the ones who said you had the sexiest voice ever." And with the most booming voice, he embraced me like an old friend and said that all his kids and his kids' friends had told him about it. He then marched me over. I was so embarrassed. He marched me over to my MP, Keir Starmer, who I had said to him, "Oh my God, Keir Starmer's here. I love him. I'm like his groupie." And he just said in the most booming voice, "Keir, this is Dolly Alderton. She says I have the sexiest voice in broadcasting. And she says she's one of your groupies." Everyone turned around. It was so embarrassing. But anyway, he's a very charming and funny and interesting
man. Did you have
man.
Any kind of intrigue left about you at all after that?
No, and I literally looked over at Jane Garvey, who just sort of like shook her head disapprovingly.
Your friendship was over already. Continuing The High-Low's MO as a Brexit-free podcast, just the briefest surf across the tumultuous waves, Theresa May has announced that she's stepping down as Prime Minister on June the 7th. The Brexit Party, with former UKIP leader Nigel Farage as their leader, is a clear winner at the EU elections, and Bojo remains fave to be PM, which is terrifying, but he's had a good haircut, so that's half the problem dealt with.
It is utterly terrifying. A YouGov poll has found that 39% of Tory party members want Boris Johnson.
Beloved children's author Judith Carr died last week, aged 95. You may think you don't know who she is, but I suspect you've heard of When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit or The Tiger Who Came to Tea.
I love The Tiger Who Came to Tea.
I mean, just the most wonderful book, and still just so gorgeous to read. 50 years later, I think it came out.
It's so lovely as well, actually, because a couple of weeks ago at the British Book Awards, she won this huge like lifetime award, and she gave this like really, really lovely video
over VT.
Yeah, VT of her acceptance, where she seemed like such a gracious and charming woman. So obviously it's so sad that we've lost her, but it's also lovely that there was that tribute so recently for her.
Speaking of my childhood, the Spice Girls played their first concert to mixed review. Apparently it all felt a bit beleaguered and out of date, said Laura Snapes.
Yeah, Laura Snapes' review of it was very funny. My favourite quote from it is, "Incidentally, the new branding is great, a graphic monochrome redux of their iconic logos. But no savvy makeover can compensate for the elephant in the room, if it's not perverse to call the professionally slender Victoria Beckham that. There is not, as was rumoured, a loving tribute to Posh, who finally gets her dues in the breakdown of Wannabe. Easy V doesn't come for free." Horner sings before changing the words, "Where is she?" And she and Mel B cackle like a pair of gleeful Tory backbenchers. I just think that's such like classic, brilliant Laura Snapes writing, because the thing that she says throughout the review, which I think is kind of unavoidable, is that sense of like anarchy and, you know, working class girls breaking into the world with like such verve and unselfconsciousness. They can't recreate that now. They can't be sticking it to the man anymore because they are...
She did say there's small mercies for the fact that they haven't created any new material.
Yeah. And well, the other thing she said that I found interesting, which I think we forget because the Spice Girls for you and I and Girls of Our Generation felt so all-encompassing. Truly, it felt like it spanned my entire childhood. They only put out 3 albums. So she said...
It's like Fawlty Towers.
They're the Fawlty Towers of pop. So she said that when you go to these big tours that they do... It's not enough material, really, to sustain a huge, spectacular show.
That being said, I was merch surfing and I would really like a Spice tea. There's one that is the spit of one I had age 10.
Let's find you
Have
one.
A look. There's
the new merch?
Yeah, there's extensive options.
I want to get us some vintage merch, I think.
Find us some vintage ones, age 9, they'll probably all be.
I've got some rather lovely news. The use of bird feeders in gardens. has dramatically increased the variety of birds living in Britain's urban areas. I've realised I particularly love when this show gets a little bit...
Nature.
BBC Radio Somerset, yeah. At least half of homeowners feed garden birds, a trend that began in the 1970s. And as a result of that, there's been a rise in woodpeckers, wood pigeons and goldfinches. OK, I think this stat is actually quite extraordinary. There were 8% of goldfinches at feeders in 1972 and 82% in 2012.
Why were people not feeding birds before the 70s?
I don't know.
What happened culturally to make people start feeding birds? And does that include ducks in the pond? Go away and do some more research.
Okay, I'll go...
You're underprepared for this.
I will go research it thoroughly. Something to do with free love?
Something to do with free love. Such a generic answer.
I think that's probably it. Can you give me a nice piece of news, please?
Oxbridge has its first black female master. I know it seems staggering that in 2019 this is the first black female master that they've had, but there you go. Jesus College has appointed Sunita Allen, a former television executive and businesswoman who attended Cambridge 30 years ago and is now the master of Jesus College, and she was awarded an OBE in 2004, so they are very lucky to have her. I was reading all about her, actually, and you just have to hope this will lead to more women from our diversity of backgrounds actually being
considered
in those positions, those like helming those top positions at Oxbridge. I will always remember, when were we talking about when Effua, I think it was in Slay in Your Lane, when Effua Hirsch said that when she was at Oxford, whenever she was just walking around the grounds with black male friends of hers, people would always approach them asking them to buy drugs. I just think that gives some insight into, I mean, we know how undiverse many institutions are, but
Oxbridge I think is particularly, and it's actually something I learned so much about when I read Effa's incredible book Brit-ish, where she talks about being a black person in Oxbridge and how traumatizing so much of that seems to have been.
Yeah, I mean, David Lammy talks about it a lot as well. There's a wealth of information out there should you be so interested to read up on it, and you should be.
Because again, this is like where we really need to take the conversation of how we end racism on further, is that like it's not enough to get people of colour into places of power where they rightly should be. It's about how we treat them when they're there.
I was recently reading in the newspaper a small news story about two 21-year-old Cambridge graduates called Aray Okunbayi and Chelsea Bourke, who have written a book called Taking Up Space, published by Stormzy's Murky Books, imprint at Penguin, about how the challenges weren't necessarily getting into Cambridge, but existing or navigating a space that wasn't necessarily welcoming towards young black women or didn't have that kind of cultural infrastructure, basically. So all of this is really interesting, and all I think really contributes to how good the news is that Sunita is now a master, because that will really change the experience that black students have at Oxbridge.
You would hope so.
From the admissions through to how they kind of enjoy their university experience itself.
It's been a bad week for Game of Thrones fans when more than a million viewers signed a petition demanding that the final season be remade, this time with competent writers.
Are they crowdfunding as well?
I just think it's
probably only about 10 million to do one episode of that.
It's so pathetic. And the thing that I've found particularly pathetic about the whole enchilada is that the website for which this petition was hosted was change.org.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah, that's,
God,
the real,
that is so insulting.
That's the real change we need in the world right now.
Do you really think this petition will work? I mean, those fans are rabid, aren't they? As someone who's never watched Game of Thrones, I do find the epic fan culture, like nothing I've ever seen, quite intriguing. Question for you. If the OC or Friends or Sex and the City were going now in the age of social media, I mean, those were the biggest series of my teenage years, would fans be that rabid about those?
Totally. Although I do think that there's a particular subculture of fan, which is the fantasy
the
fan.
The Hobbity.
Oh my God, we're going to get so trolled for saying that.
Well, there are trolls there too.
There is a particular...
Did they find the ring though? That's what I wonder.
But they do just get very overexcited, all of them. My mum is one of them. She just gets, she's beside herself about all the dragons, and she just, she really takes over a lot of her life and a lot of her thinking, and it's worrying.
She should get some Thrones therapy. It's probably offered online, actually.
You know what I think it is, actually, in all seriousness? So I spoke to Jessie Cave about kind of commitment to the notion of fantasy.
Because she's obviously embedded that with the Harry Potter fan culture.
Totally, and she has to go to these, you know, conventions and meet these diehard
fans. And they get cross with her when she gives the wrong spell.
And she said, she was actually very respectful and admiring of them. And she said, you know, these are people for whom, when you're that committed to fantasy, you have to believe in a way, and create in your head an entire second realm in which you find catharsis, relatability, healing, intrigue. And I think maybe that as a viewer or a reader is more laborious than other sorts of fiction or stories. So perhaps that's why you feel more invested in the outcome or something. I don't know.
Wingardium Leviosa.
In more uplifting news, a tech billionaire has promised to pay off student loans for an entire graduating class at Morehouse College in Atlanta.
I love this story.
Robert F. Smith was delivering the commencement address to nearly 400 students graduating this year from the historically black all-male school, which is also Martin Luther King's alma mater, when he made the surprise announcement. It was received with frenzied cheering. Students in America typically leave college with about $30,000 to $40,000 in outstanding loans, which means he'll be handing over an estimated $12 million. Isn't that amazing? It's the stuff of Spielberg scenes. I don't know quite what I would have done or felt if I was told on graduation day that my student loan was being completely paid off. And that's obviously in England, particularly the time that I was a student, smaller than the sum we're talking about in America. So it must really have been a magical moment.
And that's an amazing thing to do. I can't even imagine that. Imagine when he first approached college and he was like, look, I've got this idea.
I was wondering, like, imagine if it's like something that just came to him in the speech. I don't think it would have been that, would it? A part of me was like, I wonder if that was like premeditated, or whether maybe on the day it was something he decided.
I don't know much about him, but I'm guessing he's a man that's probably quite
strategic
in his endeavours.
Yeah.
So he's probably got a foundation or an education foundation as well. But it's
such a generous, beautiful thing to do, I think, when you're someone who's benefited from wealth, to be able to give back like that.
Is that the school he went to?
No, I don't think it was.
Yeah, that's really lovely.
Yeah.
What's in the mailbag this week, doll?
There was, unsurprisingly, a lot of conversation in response to our discussion of the proposed Alabama abortion ban and the ongoing crisis in Northern Ireland. A number of listeners shared their personal stories of deciding to have terminations, which were moving and insightful. Here is one. I'm one of the so-called shagged at 19 and got pregnant. At the time, I knew I wasn't in a position to raise a child. My boyfriend is a pro-lifer, but let me make the decision about what to do. It was my body, he said, and he had no right to choose for me. He has these views as his mum had him really young at 18, so he doesn't see age or wealth as a determiner for raising a child. No part of me took this decision lightly. I knew it was extremely serious and I knew I had a choice. I'm in some ways lucky, according to my friends, as I had a miscarriage the day I was going to have an abortion. I couldn't imagine being questioned about if I induced it myself and feel so much for these women who go through such a horrible experience and then get questioned if it were done herself or not. This happened several years ago, but imagining going through that and knowing I had no options breaks my heart. I'm on my way to build a future for myself and I couldn't do that with a child.
This email really struck me for a few reasons, which is that she's obviously still with her boyfriend.
Yeah.
So I think that's just really joyous in these polarised times that they had different views on something so important, but that he supported her. I think it actually offers a humane insight into someone who is pro-life.
Exactly. I hadn't thought about, you know, how that could feel for someone like a very valid reason to be anti-choice.
We had a couple of midwives write in as well. One community midwife wrote in with this email about what she described as a public misunderstanding of our role. Midwives do not bring life into the world. We are not magical or mysterious or witchy. We are simply advocates for women's health and women's rights, looking after women regardless of their choices. It is, after all, the women that bring life into the world. Perhaps the most unimportant role of a midwife is watching a baby be born. There is so much more work to be done in protecting women, nurturing families, delivering evidence-based practice, listening to people's voices, and working to reduce inequalities. The English word midwife is defined as with woman. The French, sage-femme, means wise woman. Another midwife had this to say, I have never had an abortion myself, but have facilitated in the safe and chosen termination of pregnancies as part of my job. The women I sit by, counsel, provide medication, information and tea for are not evil or Satanists. They are just as important and valid users of our fantastic NHS as the women who come to start their families. The journeys and reasons that bring them here are so varied, and I am yet to meet a woman who makes this decision lightly. The thought that I should take the opportunity to shame or interrogate them at such a fragile moment is disgusting, never mind immoral. It's important to allow them to acknowledge that decision at whatever degree feels right to them. The knowledge that some people have to hide their faces or lie at airports makes me so sad. The fact that both women and competent healthcare providers are being punished makes me furious. I wish I could hold all their hands and make them feel stronger for their experience.
Thank you so much for writing those. I found them very insightful and enlightening. In response to our conversation about Uber silent mode, we got this brilliant and quite heartwarming story from Edinburgh. In the quagmire of quiet Uber and the aggressively antisocial, I thought you'd enjoy a teaspoonful of Hyacinth Bouquet-esque Edinburgh panic. A few months ago, Edinburgh's local bus service began running new style buses, in which the exit from the bus is now in the middle of the bus, as opposed to at the front next to the driver. The new buses look very swanky, but have caused considerable upset. Not because they're uncomfortable, slow, or in any way rubbish, but because travellers can no longer say thank you to the driver. This is almost a law in Edinburgh, and tourists are frequently tutted at for getting off the bus without saying a thank you. The new buses mean that travellers now have to shout it across the heads of their fellow travellers, which is obviously antithetical to good Edinburgh bus etiquette.
I love that.
What have you been enjoying this week, Panda?
I was completely engrossed in the first two episodes of a BBC six-parter, Years and Years, written by Russell T Davies, starring...
Oh, I love him.
Emma Thompson as a fascist MP. The drama starts in 2019 and it will track to 2035. By the end of episode two, we're in 2024 and it's really Black Mirror.
Oh, I don't know how I didn't know about this.
Oh, God, it's... Ollie and I were gripped. The increase of China's power, the invention of a president for life, so Putin has made a president for life, nuclear war started by Trump, Snapchat filters for everyday life, coffees cost £12, entry to Kensington is now means tested,
oh my God.
Being trans means transhumanism, eradicating your body and living in the cloud. Focusing on the Lyons family, it's a dystopian family drama which deals with familial dynamics one minute, Russell Tovey breaking up with his husband, his sister having a baby, and then global politics the next. It's absolutely fascinating and
absolutely terrifying. I cannot recommend.
Oh, I must. What, that sounds like the opposite of hangover viewing, so I'll watch that when I'm clear-headed.
I think it is the opposite of hangover viewing. I have also been loving this week The Salt Path, which I'm reading.
Oh, I really want to read
by
that.
By Raina Wynne. It's a beautiful book. It really lives up to its hype. You will love it, Dolly. And it's got such broad appeal. My mum would love it too.
Yeah.
Raina and her husband Moth are left homeless after an investment goes wrong and a friend betrays them. And the loss of their farm in Wales means that they lose both their jobs too, as they'd run a holiday rental business, which is £48 coming in per week, and Moth suffering from a terminal degenerative disease called CBD. They are heartbroken and traumatised, and instead of applying for a local council house, they decide to take a 630-mile walk. The Salt Path is about their walking of the southwest coast path, spread over two summers, in the hope that nature will offer them salvation. It isn't an easy journey. They're exhausted, sunburnt, wild camping in often freezing weather, and often too broke to afford anything more to eat than packed noodles. But slowly, the landscape offers them a redemption and a way through the grief. Mm. It's also a really powerful piece of writing, and I think this is very much what Raina writes about now, about what it is to be homeless. And she very much lays bare the reactions from people when they tell them that they are walking the Southwest Coast Path because they are homeless. You know, dog leashes are retracted, people back away with their children, rather than pretending that they are on a big retirement adventure, which people just love the sound of. Some people are very kind, many are horrible, which, you know, is a reflection of humanity across the kind of natural setting. It's a true journey through humanity, and it's a really enjoyable, gentle, yet moving read.
I really, really want to read that, because I also think that...
I'll give it to you next week. Yeah,
I'd love to read it, because I also think that something that I found so baffling, particularly as I've got older and due to, like, certain personal experiences that I've had, is how many people I know who seem to be utterly convinced that homelessness is something that happens 500 miles away from them and is something that they are never in danger of having to confront. And I know that, you know, there but for the grace of God for all of us. And it's something that we need to really understand and be compassionate and sympathetic towards, rather than thinking of it as an alien state or a tragedy determined by choices in life or something that's just so far away from our existence, because that's just so not the case.
The book totally looks at that, and it looks at quite a lot of other cultural things as well, actually. Raina feels kind of very attached to the land since she was young, as her father was a tenant farmer on sort of a big estate, so she's always felt like there is kind of this solace to be found in the natural land, and she's untrusting of you know, those people in the big houses.
Yeah.
And she doesn't, and I think there's a real sense of them not wanting to rely on anyone.
Yeah.
When they became homeless, they stay with friends for a while, but they feel kind of painfully aware that staying anywhere for more than a couple of weeks is an inconvenience if you can't offer anyone any money.
Yeah.
So it's definitely an exploration of a lot of that as well. I also loved Eva Wiseman's column this weekend on why life is shades of grey, which is totally the Hilo's MO. She's writing about why she avoids giving opinions on telly because of the dangerous lack of nuance. It's not just the method of pitting two people against each other that causes problems, treating each argument as equally valid, regardless of whether it's over hamburgers or the death penalty, as if all points of view, including Islamophobia or climate scepticism, are legitimate. Not just that this poking and growling induces an aggressive hopelessness in audiences with its lessons that every thought is worth a fight. And it's not just that nobody wins or that minds are rarely changed, though these are truths that have resulted in an overwhelming feeling that all discourse remains not so much in a bubble, but covered with its own particular sticky film, the bubble having dissolved under heat and settled like a cheap trap. The problem is that whether on Jeremy Kyle or the Today programme or online, grand, complicated issues are presented as binary arguments, not allowing for nuance or the necessary messiness of real human life. It's a great piece. Mm. I'll link in ye old show notes.
Very much pertaining to our interests, as you
absolutely
say.
Pertaining to our interests. And lastly, I also loved Hadley Freeman's column on abortion, which I wish I'd had before last week's show, but hey, the issue's ongoing, so it's still a relevant read right now. Before anyone gets out the bunting, she writes, I do think the pro-life side might have erred a little, because banning abortion isn't the most effective place to start. In fact, it is demonstrably anti-life.
Nicolae Ceaușescu banned access to contraception and abortion in Romania in 1966, and by 1989, 10,000 women, at a very conservative estimate, had died from illegal abortions. 170,000 children were abandoned in filthy orphanages. Not so much pro-life as pro-state sanctioned murder and abuse then. And then she suggests other ways of being pro-life, which I just thought was so valuable. Improve maternal healthcare. While we're at it, campaign for universal healthcare, ban guns, vaccinations, sort out the climate crisis. So I love that column. Just a
very interesting perspective of coming to something that everyone is talking about.
Exactly, coming to the pro-life debate and asking questions about what pro-life does mean. Mm. Dol, what have you enjoyed this week?
I have been really enjoying The C Word on Luminary, which is a new podcast platform app which has a number of different, mainly American podcasts on it. So I'm on Luminary for Guys We Fucked because I'm a long-time fucker, as they call us. Just for anyone who's not familiar, that's very much the
It's like calling yourself a high-lower.
It's the term they call
their
listeners.
They're not the same thing.
And not indicative or any sort of boast about my own sexual prowess. Also for The C Word, and I think Russell Brand has a series on there as well, which I'd like to listen to. Anyway, The C Word is totally brilliant. It's hosted by Lena Dunham and Alyssa Bennett. And The C Word is in reference to crazy. And it's about, it's a series in which every episode focuses on a different female figure in public life who the media or culturally we have deemed crazy. And it's such a delicious mix of kind of searing psychological, social commentary and gender analysis and analysis of the feminine and the female, and a really thoughtful look at all the various ways that we have tried to keep women small and shamed and silent. So there's that side of things, but it's also just sort of great pop culture nostalgia and relaying and discussion of kind of big pop culture
events. They talk about Britney.
So the first episode, which I loved, it's being released like episodes kind of week on week, which is good because otherwise I would have binge listened to the whole thing this weekend. The first one I loved, which is about Casey Johnson.
I don't know who that is.
So I wasn't familiar with her either. She's like, she was an heiress of the Johnson & Johnson family, and she was very much, she was kind of deemed an it girl around the time of Nicole Richie and Paris Hilton and The Simple Life. There was a huge amount of scandal around her family, which they delve into. She was latterly known for being in relationships with lots of high profile women, including women like Tila Tequila. And then she died very tragically and prematurely. And they managed to discuss these stories that are in parts very funny or salacious and in other parts deeply tragic with a total ease, kind of switching through all
tonally. That's the skill.
Yeah, and you just feel completely safe in their hands as hosts. She's been a number of different things. Now I think she's an art curator. She was a model. She's a longtime friend of Lena Dunham's. She's a very, very smart woman. And there's a nice mix within their discussions of sincerity, compassion, earnestness, and also lots of, you know, cynicism and humour and dark humour and reality. You know, lots of real talk.
That sounds really interesting. I'm just trying to weigh up if I can do another paywall.
I know. I have to say, I think this series is so well produced. It's so well produced and presented. And the other thing that I really enjoy about it, but I know that would put a lot of people off, is that Lena Dunham often speaks about this subject of women being deemed crazy as someone who has been deemed pretty crazy for reasons either valid or invalid, depending on where you stand, over the last couple of years. So she kind of puts a lot of her experience into the discussion on, you know, fame, celebrity, the objectification of women, the kind of hysteria and rapid rise of women we deem idols, and then the kind of subsequent tearing down.
As I say, I know for some people Lena Dunham is such a controversial character that that might tarnish their listening experience. For me, I think it actually imbues it with another really interesting layer as someone who has been in the public eye from a very young age and has said a number of controversial things, as well as had some in her earlier life unfair treatment at the hands of the media, I would say.
Yeah.
The series, which is 10 episodes, includes women such as Katie Johnson, Robin Givens, Mariah Carey and Jean Seberg. So it's a really interesting kind of diverse mix of subjects. So very much enjoyed that. I loved reading the writer Octavia Bright and a friend of mine who is a fantastically talented and compassionate and thoughtful writer and academic, delving into the concept of scarcity for Elle Online and what scarcity means for the progression of women, this very misogynistic idea that there's only a finite amount of success, which is obviously a very misogynistic and clever tool because it really kind of pits women against each other. And it was just a really interesting dig into that concept. To quote her, "Seeing a scarcity thinking feeds jealousy and feelings of inadequacy. Shifting your perspective from lack to abundance is the answer. Your personal experience is only part of the story, and we all have so much to learn if we listen to the experiences of those different from us. And understanding the limits of your own experience isn't frightening if you believe that the collective will support you. Scarcity is a fixed position. Abundance leaves room for growth. Empathy and sisterhood are kryptonite to Mean Girls and the scarcity mindset. Love is profoundly political," writes American author and activist Bell Hooks. "The transformative power of love is the foundation of all meaningful social change. Sincerity and compassion may not be very trendy right now, but the need for progress is too urgent to be sacrificed for the sake of being edgy. Cynicism can feel protective, but it works against us in stealthy ways too." I just think it was such a good piece, and I also love any writer who can quote both Bell Hooks and Regina George with similar weight and reverence. I went on a bit of a cinematic white knuckle ride last night when I saw the new Elton John biopic Rocket Man. Have you heard about this?
I've heard of it, but I haven't heard any reviews of it. I'm hoping you're about to give me one.
Pretty crazy. It was it's incredibly...
It's Taron Egerton who plays Elton John.
Yeah, what a hottie.
Cool.
And Richard Madden.
Mm.
Sadly, already Googled. First one is taken. Richard is, according to Google, single. So that was my main take home from Rocket Man.
No, their performances, both of their performances are really, really brilliant. The tone of it is bizarrely theatrical. You feel like you're watching a stage show, West End stage show. In fact, I'm sure it will end up as a West End stage show. I'm a massive fan of musicals. I've never seen a musical in which getting into the songs is such a clunky
ordeal.
It was an ordeal for everyone. It was an ordeal for everyone in that cinema, and it was an ordeal for everyone on screen. Truly, it got to a point, I went with Farley, and it got to a point where the transitions, they just couldn't be arsed by the end, I think, to even bother making it seamless. They did one transition and Farley got annoyed to me because I just went no really loudly in the whole cinema, turn around. But I didn't realise, I thought that it was going to be a film with the Elton John back catalogue. I didn't realise it was a film where Elton John's grandma is standing in a kitchen in Pinner and suddenly is just doing the washing up and warbling, "I want love, just a different kind." It was so weird. But on the flip side, the music of Elton John is so, so brilliant, and I loved that as a celebration, and it reminded me of what an incredible artist he is. And I really, really enjoyed learning about Elton John's incredibly extreme rise to fame and the pain and trauma that he endured in his family life as an adolescent man and in the early days of fame. So that learning more about Elton John was fascinating. The last thing I'll say on it is that there's been kind of chatter around it because the first names that came up in the credit were Elton John and David Furnish as
exact producer.
Yeah, yeah. And it was in co-pro with a company called Rocket Productions. And at the end,
co-pro.
At the end, there's so it has this like it takes you up to the point of when he gets clean, and then at the end, there's this extraordinary montage as the credits roll of like an update on Elton John's life, where you just really feel the hand of Elton John, where it's just a series of pictures of him, and it says things like Elton John has now been sober for 26 years. He's been with David Furnish for 25 years, who is the real love of his life. He started this charitable foundation, which has made X amount of millions and hundred millions of pounds. And it just felt a bit like, you know, when you work in a company and there's like, you're shown a video about the company that's like circulated internally. It's like, here's kind of all the things.
It's a press release.
Yeah.
I think unless you're Edward St. Albin and you write a book like Patrick Melrose, which is as scathing about yourself and your errors in life as everyone else, it's kind of impossible to make a kind of cinematic autobiography
of
that
course.
Isn't going to be anything other than
a piece of propaganda.
Yeah, it's propaganda, like, that's the word, not press release.
Totally. Propaganda. It's like, there was this bit on the last in the last scene where someone, it's like these kind of swelling violins and it's this really big dramatic moment and someone in Elton's life comes up to him and holds him by the arms and says, Elton, you've made songs that millions and millions of people love. And I was just like, oh, I don't know.
Sorry
about
on
this.
Those.
I'm not sure about this. So yeah, it was like, if you like the music of Elton John, it's fun, but it's quite a strange viewing experience, I would say.
I want to go and read some reviews now. Have they said similar things to you?
I haven't actually read any of the reviews, but the only thing that I've heard is that there is this, you really do feel Elton
his
John.
His presence.
Yeah, you feel his presence there.
Anything else that you've enjoyed in a slightly less strangulated way?
I came across a poem that I wanted to share with you because I think you will love it, that one of my very, very dear friends sent to me, who is going through a difficult time at the moment. And this particular poem, she sent it and just said, this is so beautiful. And I was so moved when I read it. And I think it is a very soothing meditation for anyone who might find themselves in a moment of despair. It's called Wait by Galway Kinnell. Wait for now. Distrust everything if you have to. But trust the hours. Haven't they carried you everywhere up to now? Personal events will become interesting again. Hair will become interesting. Pain will become interesting. Buds that open out of season will become interesting. Second-hand gloves will become lovely again. Their memories are what give them the need for other hands. The desolation of lovers is the same. That enormous emptiness carved out of such tiny beings as we are asked to be filled. The need for the new love is faithfulness to the old. Wait. Don't go too early. You're tired, but everyone's tired. But no one is tired enough. Only wait a little and listen. Music of hair, music of pain, music of looms weaving our loves again. But there to hear it, it will be the only time, most of all, to hear your whole existence, rehearsed by the sorrows, play itself into total exhaustion. It's just so rare that I come across new poetry, and I am not familiar with his work, and I just thought it was very, very beautiful, so I hope some of you enjoyed it as much as I did.
It is, and when you read it aloud, there's a lovely weight to it.
I also loved Nina Stibbe on Adam Buxton, who is such a brilliant writer and just a brilliant, brilliant woman. I totally adore her. She's so funny. And for anyone who's not familiar with her work, I cannot recommend enough Love, Nina. Have you read Love, Nina?
I haven't, but I have heard of it.
So if I could press one book into the hands of people to make them laugh, of any book I've ever
one
read,
book.
One book it would be Love,
okay,
Nina.
Okay, fine, I shall buy it.
Love, Nina made me laugh more than any other book I've ever read. And I implore you to go and buy it immediately. It's a memoir told in letters. It's about Nina, who moved to London from Leicester in her late teens,
and got a job working on Gloucester Crescent, which is this kind of...
Oh, I watched it on telly with Helena Bonham Carter.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yes, I love that. Okay, I need to go read it now.
Yeah, she moved on to Gloucester Crescent, which had this kind of literary tradition in the 80s. It's this beautiful road in Camden where Alan Bennett lived, and she was working for a woman who, forgive me, I can't remember her name, but she was the editor for the London Review of Books, and she was nannying her two sons. And it's just the funniest account of a really kind of earnest but cynical, wide-eyed, very down-to-earth teenage girl giving an account of kind of pretentious London life and navigating her way through it, and navigating her way through all the other things that girls of that age are navigating, and sending letters back to her sister. And it's just so charming and so, so funny. So definitely that should be the gateway drug to Nina Sibbie. And you should also listen to her and Adam Buxton. There was a real rapport between them. They talk about lots of different things, be it the professional or the domestic or what it's like to be a parent, and they agree on lots of stuff. And the clip that I'd like to insert here is both of them talking about sex. They were talking, and I don't know, I love reading about sex, but I find writing about sex quite difficult. And they come at this idea of sex positivity from a different angle that I don't know if I necessarily agree with, but I just found it very, very, very interesting and thoughtful.
I do not like writing about sex.
No, okay. But it pops up a little more than it does in David Sedaris's work.
He has sex in his diaries, but he says, after the sex, I thought such and such. So we know he's had it, but he doesn't describe it. Thank God.
Right. It's the sort of final frontier, I would say, quite rightly. I feel very conflicted about the sex positive modern world where people are trying to be all groovy and positive about pornography and sex in general. And like, let's get it out in the open. Let's talk about it. Yes, let's not feed people's hang-ups and let's make it a sort of inclusive, non-judgmental environment. Great. But let's not remove all the things that are fun about sex, the kind of furtive, creeping around secret aspect.
This is it. Yeah, no, I haven't heard many people say that, because some people sort of don't want to read about it and don't want it out in the open, and other people do. But it does slightly ruin it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's something that actually resonates with me a bit. I always used to think, I remember when I was a teenager and I used to think how weird it would be if we were all bananas, and when you and when you lost your virginity, you were a peeled banana.
Yeah.
I was like, imagine if it was that flagrant when you had had sex with someone. And I don't know, I don't want to be a peeled banana. So
do you know what? After I had sex for the first time, I was a bloody peeled banana.
Oh my God!
You should have seen me walking around with the biggest grin on my face.
That, there you go, that is literally the difference in the opposing sides of that conversation.
I basically sent out a round robin email to everyone I knew to let them know.
Public service announcement. A PSA from Dolly Alderton.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What makes a happy woman? A talk at Hay Festival this weekend by behavioural scientist Paul Dolan has gone viral after he said that women without children or a spouse are happier. A professor at the London School of Economics, who was there to promote his new book, Happy Ever After, Dolan said that traditional markers used to measure success did not correlate with happiness, particularly marriage and raising children. Here are a selection of quotes. Married people are happier than other population subgroups, but only when their spouse is in the room. When the spouse is not present, fucking miserable. We do have some good longitudinal data following the same people over time, but I'm going to do a massive disservice to that science and just say, if you're a man, you should probably get married. If you're a woman, don't bother.
Men benefited from marriage because they calmed down, he said. You take less risks, you earn more money at work, you live a little longer. She, on the other hand, has to put up with that and die sooner than if she never married. The healthiest and happiest population subgroup are women who never married or had children. Dolly, was this talk the buzz of Hay?
It was, and it was the buzz of the internet as well. I don't think I've ever seen a talk at a literary festival start such a fast and impassioned and widely circulated debate. And I have to say, I have read and heard that claim about marriage and children enhancing the lives of men and taking from the lives of women a number of times before.
Yeah.
I think there's something really interesting in that claim and those findings about the effect of committed long-term monogamy in child raising, the effect on both men and women, the differences and the similarities. And I do think we have to be able to delve into it without people who've chosen to get married or have children seeing it as an attack on their choices.
I found Dolan's theories sort of radical and at the same time not at all radical. You know, sort of riveting but familiar.
Yeah.
His words actually reminded me of Simone de Beauvoir, who, speaking 70 years ago, whenever it was, said, "Man attaches himself to woman not to enjoy her, but to enjoy himself."
I've never heard that quote before. It's enormously powerful.
I really appreciate his honesty in that talk. I think marriage, culturally speaking, does do more for a man than a woman. To address his other points, I think a lot of the time when people get married, they cease to act as independent entities. So that bit about someone being fucking miserable when their spouse isn't in the room made me laugh.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people for whom that's true.
Yeah.
They don't know how to function as a solo anymore. And I think that modern motherhood, where you are essentially juggling two full-time jobs as a mother homemaker and also as a working professional, is seriously hard, and happiness is a contrast of terms. So to look at a life which is freer, more flexible, less exhausting, typically, not always, and with less disposable income, then yeah, that would probably constitute happiness for a lot of women. Obviously, the only glitch in studies like these is that there is no one single woman who is both married and mothering and simultaneously single and without children.
Yeah,
and the only way
exactly
to ever get an accurate reading is to have GCSE science, useful, huh? The exact same variables in an environment. So to measure happiness across two different lives in a comparative sense is impossible.
And as you said, even in individual lives, there are two different questions here which demand two very different investigations and answers. The first is the effect of having children on women, and the second is the effect of marriage.
Yeah, they're not... It's interesting how they were bound in the same package, because they're not the same thing.
No, they're very, very different experiences. We know, as you say, already it has been discussed, the deep joy and fulfilment that can come from being a mother, as well as the extraordinary compromises that have to be made to life, identity, relationships, and possibly happiness. We're talking more and more about that, and I really appreciate that sort of honesty that's coming out of the sort of slummy mummy movement of women sharing the true highs and lows of parenthood that up until now have been very much whispered because society has historically always wanted women to have babies. The marriage side of the claim really interests me because I do often think about the traditional gendered difference of that experience in general terms. It's something that actually Corinne Fisher, who's a comedian and the co-host of Guys We Fucked, has spoken about really compellingly before, about how in relationships she feels women often give much more than they receive in return, and how so much of this relates back to the supposed biological demands of women to nurture. I think these are all really interesting observations, and certainly I don't think it applies to all marriages or all families or all individuals. I think the requirements for contentment are so idiosyncratic, which, you know, per person, per individual, often irrelevant of gender, and sometimes that does get lost in these debates.
Always gets lost in those debates because it's only ever sort of hypothetical collective, isn't it? On a personal level, I was having a think about this. Am I happier now than I was before I met my husband and had my daughter? Yes, I am. But it's important to note that what's changed in that time is that I am more established in my career. I know myself and what is important to me so much better than I did 10 years ago. And I have more disposable income. I come from a conventional background. It's very normal in my social circle to get married and have children. But I still know that marriage and children is the right choice for me. That said, it's not for everyone, and there's still so much stigma around that.
Mm. I totally agree. There's still so much shame around women who choose not to have children, and the pity thrown at them
really must rob them of their sense of self or pride or achievement or purpose, when actually having children, as we discussed in the last episode, is such an enormous decision and responsibility. And it's a decision that has such a butterfly effect that I think I'm only really grasping now. It's a kind of self-elected ability to parent that has an impact on not just the parents' lives, but on the new life that you're bringing into the world. The people who come into contact with that new life, how they move through the world and how they might treat their children and on the environment as well. It's not something to be taken lightly. And if someone decides it's something they want to forego for whatever reasons they choose, we should applaud them for their consideration.
Dolan addressed that really brilliantly, I thought. You see a single woman of 40 who's never had children. He said, bless, that's a shame, isn't it? Maybe one day you'll meet the right guy and that'll change. No, maybe she'll meet the wrong guy and that'll change. Maybe she'll meet a guy who makes her less happy and healthy and die sooner.
A couple of years ago, I listened to a Radio 4 mini-episode of a discussion between the journalist Grace Dent and the writer Sian Harries, which I think I actually spoke on the Hilo about at the time, about not having children, and I found it so powerful, and I think about it all the time. It's incredibly raw and articulate and honest. And I wanted to insert a clip of it here that is a point of the discussion that I think about a lot.
I worried and worried and worried and worried about that. This moment where suddenly that you're struck down, that with this pang of regret and sadness that eventually crucifies your whole life, and then you end up like a kind of a Disney figure, kind of like crying, screaming into a mirror, you know, an evil woman,
getting younger woman taken into the woods and killed,
all of that type of thing. And then I started to realise that when those moments do come, I do sometimes have a moment and I just let it enter and then go, because it does. I have lots of regrets in my life, right? Mm. I really regret that I can't play the piano amazingly. I can't play it at all. But there's still a part of me that thinks, sometimes I just think, oh, wouldn't it have been wonderful? I can't speak French very well. I can speak it badly.
These are all things, though, that could be changed. You could learn how to play the piano.
And I could have a baby.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I could. I could... We're speaking in London right now.
Yes.
I could walk out of this room. I could go to Harley Street, which is 1 mile away. Mm-hmm. I could walk in and I could say, how much money do I need to fling to have a baby? And they would say, £47,000, mm-hmm. and you'll have one by next June. And what I would say is, with the regret, I have moments where I just think, oh, everything would be wonderful if I was still with my ex-husband and we had 3 children now. And then just I let it into me and then it goes in mm-hmm. exactly the same way as I think, God, I really, really wish that I'd stayed in that band when I was 20. I really wish I'd stayed in that band. It would have been amazing. And we would have played Glastonbury and then we would have gotten, by now I would be like Shirley Manson and I'd probably live in LA or like Annie Lennox, because blah, 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 blah. And then you forget. The moment that my friends had babies, there was this idea that my life was kind of flimsy and flippant and luxurious, always luxurious, you know. And I mean, I noticed it exactly the other day. A friend of mine, she got pregnant and immediately she said something to me. Gosh, this has come at such a bad time in my life, because I just got to the point where I really thought that I was going to spend the next 6 months drinking Cosmopolitans every Friday night. And I just thought, what, do you think that's what my life is?
Yeah.
Like, on a Friday night, I'm knackered and I come home from work and I make a bit of food and I check up on my, you know, I've still got ill parents. I've still got, yeah. I've still got a cat that needs taken to the vet. I've still got friends I need to check in on. I've still got work deadlines. I've still got things I need to do.
I just think that's such an intelligent way of framing it. The fact that regretting not having children is seen as the most number one irreversible, horrific tragedy and trauma that will haunt a woman for life. When actually, throughout all of our lives, we're making decisions all the time which stop one path of fate happening and determines another. And sadly, it's indicative of the premium that we place on domesticity and child rearing for a woman's existence, that specific road not taken is the most important, the most dangerous, the most defining, and the one that should be most feared. And I think we need to urgently change that, because I think that belief is what terrorises women as they age. And to be totally honest, I include myself in that. And it can be absolutely crippling and imprisoning. And I can also see, and I have seen, how it can lead women to make really, really bad decisions and judgments on things.
We have another smart woman giving her thoughts on this subject, as fortuitously this week, a Hilo listener recommended a 2016 interview with Terry Gross on parenting podcast The Longest Short. Now, this was really interesting because Gross doesn't have children. Rather, she came on to talk about why she chose not to have them. And I thought that was a really novel idea on a parenting podcast, a much more inclusive way of doing a parenting podcast.
Yeah.
It's such an honest conversation and it's pleasingly non-combative, given that Gross and the interviewer, who does have children, go pretty deep.
When I was young, I just assumed I would have children, I think, because that's what you did. There wasn't a choice. It was like you reached a certain age and then you got married and then you had children. But once, like, the women's movement really started up, I started thinking, wow, I see. There's a choice here. And there was a change in cultural, social atmosphere that made it acceptable to not have children, where you wouldn't be seen as either an object of ridicule or an object of pity. Oh, and then once I discovered a career that I loved, I thought, yeah, I think I'm not going to have children. Because I couldn't imagine having children and having a career. I hadn't seen any evidence it could be done.
This is something I think about all the time, because it's an inevitable truth that you make career sacrifices and life sacrifices when you have children. As Jacqueline Rose writes in Mothers, when a woman becomes a mother, she loses her freedom. I dream of renting a cabin in the mountains in the States for a month and just writing all alone. But that's just not a possibility for me. And I think any woman, working or otherwise, feels constrained by a child. You're tethered to the home, and not just in the traditional sense because of childcare, but also because you are shattered in, and I'm sorry to say it, in a way I never knew before I had a child. It does keep you indoors more, that particular type of exhaustion, and it takes almost everything to maintain and build my career and care for my child, and that's with the benefit of ample childcare when I work, and keep myself clean and vaguely presentable. Literally everything. So I think I can see why Terry Gross said I couldn't see any evidence that I could have children and have the career I wanted.
Do you think that it's affected your career, having a child?
You know what? I don't think so, but I do feel frustratingly slowed down. And I think people forget that it starts before you have a child. It starts during pregnancy. There's a scan or a doctor appointment or a midwife appointment or an NCT class almost every single week. So that takes, you know, 3 hours out of your working day that day, which makes you less able to work to your full capacity. Most women feel appalling for their first trimester, sick, bloated, exhausted. Most people don't want to, you don't want to tell people in case you have a miscarriage. So you end up mostly isolating yourself for 12 weeks. And then towards the end, speaking from personal experience, I had chronic lower back pain and a trapped nerve. So I stopped really being able to move in that last month unless I took a taxi, which I was lucky enough to be able to afford. Was it all worth it? Absolutely, without question. But I don't think we can talk about it without accepting that there are sacrifices. And I think my career and my life has actually grown and developed and benefited since I had my daughter. But that has taken a monumental amount of work, psychologically, financially, and logistically, and help from others. Does everyone have access to that kind of support? No. And I think it is worth thinking about those things, like Terry Gross clearly did, before deciding if that path is for you.
I think there are lots of women who say their career hasn't changed or has merely slowed after children. Some of those examples are because of circumstantial factors, you know, dispositional personality factors, how their job and employers work, or financial factors, as you say, or, you know, relationship factors. I also know a lot of women who've said it hasn't changed their career, having a child, but that has come at the expense of their well-being. And I also know lots of women who say it does take something away from your career and work focus or sense of boundlessness with work forever. I believe all those accounts and I hear and appreciate all of this truth. And I think all of it should be heard and believed, not least because it will help us collectively value the decision not to become a mother as much as we laud those who do.
Later in the podcast, Gross talks about why not having children was not a sacrifice for her.
it wasn't like a really difficult choice for me. I wasn't somebody who was always anguishing. I wanted to have what I thought of as an interesting life, as a life that kept me intellectually engaged, that combined some of the things I loved.
I found that quite hard to hear, the implication that I've chosen a life that is less interesting and less intellectually engaged. And I also winced when she said that she's no longer friends with people who have kids. She's very frank about it. I salute her. I did not leave room in my life for those kind of friendships, she said. And that did arouse a personal discomfort in me because, and this is entirely natural, I believe, you do worry that when you have children, you will become less interesting to people or particular friendships when you have a child. And she confirms that fear.
It's interesting because on the almost flip side of that argument, in the Grace Dent, Sian Harris discussion, there's a bit where Grace Dent is talking about how she feels like her friends, almost the opposite to what Terry's saying, that her friends with children then deemed her life to be unimportant, unfulfilled, and flimsy. And I, not from my close friends, but from people I know, from women I know, and female acquaintances, I have been made to feel that before.
So maybe that's why Terry Grace didn't make room in her life for those friendships.
Yeah.
I don't want to think that friends cannot occupy the same life experience just because one procreated and the other didn't. I do think it takes work to meet each other in the middle, certainly.
Totally.
But I really don't think it has to be impossible if that's what you want. Being a mother is an important part of my identity, but it isn't all of my identity. It's not the only thing I can relate to people about. Being a writer is, to be brutally honest, as big a part of me, honestly, as being a mother. I remember when my daughter was born and I was lying in bed exhaustedly. Both me and the baby had an infection one night, and my sister came over and she said, both bossily and wisely, "You must make different plans with your friends that don't have children. Lunch is where you don't bring the baby. You must work differently to maintain those friendships because it will be so much easier to see your friends with children." And I agree and agreed and continue to agree with her totally.
Something I've realised as I get older is how much we have to resist the temptation to look at a life route that's different to ours as being a judgment on the one we've chosen to take.
Yeah, it's such an interesting way of putting it.
I get why we do it. I see it, and I feel myself doing it sometimes, and I see people doing it with me, the kind of defensiveness that my life choice is the correct one. And I think it basically just affirms our own choices because the variables of life are so overwhelming. When you truly consider in 2019, in the Western world, all the different choices that we can make to have all these different types of lives, I think that sometimes it's so unbearable to think about the other life where you're sitting in a mountain, in a shack in the mountains.
Utah!
In Utah. All the Catskills, writing.
Are there any mountains in Utah?
I didn't want to question that.
I see my hut, okay?
Yeah, you're in the hut in the Catskills and you're writing your 50th novel. Or, you know,
I am accomplished in my parallel.
I'm in Swedish countryside surrounded by like seven blonde, beautiful children.
Interesting.
You know, sometimes it's too much to consider how many incarnations your life could have taken through a series of different choices, or just things happening to you, that I think the way that we preserve our sense of sanity is that we have to make judgments or cast aspersions on those who've done different things to us and fiercely protect the choices that we have made. But I think we need to remember, when it comes to having children, to find the universal in our experiences rather than always focusing on what defines our experiences and therefore us, and kind of trying to make our lives distinctive.
It also just comes down to empathy. Sometimes I think there is an odd sort of combative lack of empathy when a woman has children because it's such an obvious route for her to have taken. Yeah. And also, much of the time, it's her own choice. Yeah. So it's a bit of like, well, if you choose to have this delicious bundle of life and get a sweet ass maternity leave and, you know, loads of presents for your baby, then you can fucking take being really tired and pushing yourself to meet those deadlines. But there is, I have definitely felt a strange lack of empathy at times for being in that position, but I think that's something that extends both ways as well. I mean, I think it's just like empathy across the grid, isn't it?
When you have the baby, do you get presents for yourself as well as the baby, or just
no,
the baby?
Not really.
Oh, I'm not interested then.
Yeah, no, so yeah, I wouldn't bother. Yeah. Terry Gross isn't trying to speak for all women. She's offering one point of view, and I do hope it allows more women to make life choices that they might feel nervous about making because they are still considered unusual.
It's great to be a parent when you're not forced to be, when mm-hmm. society isn't demanding it, when they're not making it an obligation. And in order for it to no longer be an obligation, I think some people had to choose to not have children and rewrite the rules a little bit. And, you know, hooray for all of us.
She's so articulate, and I so admire her for speaking with such candor about something that people are still so suspicious about. I know that this is not a good time in life to offer sympathy to Theresa May, but her child-free life and the way that the media reported that was something I found not only very sad, but quite sinister. I so appreciate when a woman defends or explains or even just discusses her choice so candidly.
And without, there's like no defensiveness in Terry. Yeah, that's what I love. Exactly. She's almost coming from the other way where it's like children just not a part of her life.
Yeah.
The idea that motherhood is the enemy of feminism or perhaps a bulwark to it is not a new idea. Simone de Beauvoir, who I mentioned earlier, talked about it in The Second Sex way back in 1949. But I thought the way that the presenter of The Longest Short, Andrea Salenzi, said it was really resonated with me. You're looking at two possible versions of your life and both have tremendous benefits and losses. Mm. And I think that's it. We need
that's
to stop
exactly
valuing one over the other. Yeah. I don't much like the idea of a pendulum swinging the other way so that we see women who do have children or furthermore choose to stay at home with those children as oppressed or backward or archaic. But I'm not sure it will ever really swing that far. I think it could just get to the middle, which would be really quite nice for everyone.
Moby has become a meme in the last week, and in the worst way possible. Recently, the 53-year-old musician published a second memoir called Then It Fell Apart.
There's some foreshadowing in the title. Oh dear.
In which he claims to have dated the actress Natalie Portman. In the book, he claims they dated when he was 33 and Portman was 20 after she met him backstage in Texas. He recounts going to parties in New York with her and visiting her at Harvard University, kissing under the centuries-old oak trees. At midnight, she brought me to her dorm room and we lay down next to each other on her small bed. After she fell asleep, I carefully extracted myself from her arms and took a taxi back to my hotel. He says that he then struggled with anxiety about their relationship. It wanted one thing, for me to be alone. Nothing triggered my panic attacks more than getting close to a woman I cared about. Later, he writes, for a few weeks I tried to be Natalie's boyfriend, but it hadn't worked out, writing that she called to tell him she'd met someone else. But Natalie Portman disputes Moby's account entirely. She said, I was surprised to hear that he characterised the very short time that I knew him as dating, because my recollection is a much older man being creepy with me when I just graduated high school, she told Harper's Bazaar. He said I was 20. I definitely wasn't. I was a teenager. I had just turned 18. There was no fact-checking from him or his publisher. It almost feels deliberate. The book has their first meeting dated as early September 1999, which would have made Portman, who was born in June 1981, 18. She added, that he used this story to sell his book was very disturbing to me. It wasn't the case. There are many factual errors and inventions. I would have liked him or his publisher to reach out to fact check. She says Moby had told her, let's be friends, and that they had hung out a handful of times.
Moby then responded to her comments, posting a picture of them together on Instagram and saying that her account confused me, as we did, in fact, date. And after briefly dating in 99, we remained friends for years. I like Natalie and I respect her intelligence and activism. But to be honest, I can't figure out why she would actively misrepresent the truth about our, albeit brief, involvement. He added, I completely respect Natalie's possible regret in dating me. To be fair, I'd probably regret dating me too, but it doesn't alter the actual facts of our brief romantic history.
The latest update is that Moby has now publicly apologised to Natalie Portman via an Instagram caption that reads, as some time has passed, I've realised that many of the criticisms levelled at me regarding my inclusion of Natalie in Then It Fell Apart are very valid. I also fully recognise that it was truly inconsiderate of me to not let her know about her inclusion in the book beforehand, and equally inconsiderate for me to not fully respect her reaction. I have a lot of admiration for Natalie for her intelligence, creativity and animal rights activism, and I hate that I might have caused her and her family distress. I tried to treat everyone I included in Then It Fell Apart with dignity and respect, but nonetheless, it was truly inconsiderate for me to not let them know before the book was released. So for that, I apologise to Natalie, as well as the other people I wrote about in Then It Fell Apart without telling them beforehand. Also, I accept that given the dynamic of our almost 14-year age difference, I absolutely should have acted more responsibly and respectfully when Natalie and I first met almost 20 years ago. So I went onto his Instagram page this morning and he's done this hilarious thing where he's using his Instagram account to flag causes he feels passionately about while the media is so fixated on him. He did a video of himself yesterday in the middle of some woods, some birds chirping in the background, with him saying something along the lines of, I don't know how long I'll have all these eyes on me, so while you're here, and then he lists off all these urgent global issues such as the refugee crisis, climate change, and Western democracy being under attack. I thought this was such an arrogant and strange reaction, and actually really quite aggressive in its own way, because what he's trying to do is make out that he's so compassionate that he will utilise this bad press over something he deems to be tittle-tattle and use it to leverage awareness of, like, the, you know, the big real issues. But actually, he's just trying to remind us of what a good guy he is and is totally trying to deflect attention away from the story. I just find it such a strange way to manage it. What was your first reaction to the story?
I was titillated initially because celebrities like Natalie Portman rarely speak about things like their love lives, at least not in such an honest way or a damning way.
Yeah.
Overall, I was just baffled. I don't really understand how you think someone who is 18 is 20, for starters.
I am utterly, utterly compelled by this story, and I think it's because it is so much more than embarrassing gossip. I think it exemplifies so many current cultural issues that we're trying collectively to wade through. Within this one celebrity anecdote, there are layers and layers of current dilemmas and questions there. The first, of course, is not, you know, debating the truth of the account, but rather the claims in the account itself. Men in positions of power, whether consciously or unknowingly, utilising their status to get what they want from women. In this case, a girl, a teenage girl, who was also a fan. That's the first zeitgeist bomb that's sort of detonated within this story. Whether Natalie Portman considered they were friends or whether they were in fact romantically involved, was it ever appropriate for him to have pursued her in that context? How much agency did she have in the matter? Are we robbing her of her agency if we claim that she was too young and he was too famous for there to have ever been a balanced or equal relationship? How much was she coerced? And why did he use her youth as anecdotal currency? That's really the thing that struck me when I read the original passage. You know, romanticising her studenthood and her youth and the single bed and her fandom and her age and almost boasting about it in the book.
I think she's right that he does use her almost like a celeb hook to get people to buy the book. I liked a column by Barbara Ellen on entitlement. Trying to be charitable, I wondered if this could be a misunderstanding. Mobies. A modern cautionary tale about deep-rooted delusion. Again, Mobies.
Yeah.
Perhaps he had different ideas to Portman about what dating entailed or built up their encounters. But Moby kept tweeting with increasing sullenness about people believing lies and accusations over actual photographs and evidence before declaring he was off to save animals and the planet. Oh, Lord, I thought with a shiver, he's one of them. By them, I mean precisely the kind of self-avowed, arty liberal type who'd react with peevish, thick-skinned anger to being rejected, even if it's almost 20 years after the fact.
Yeah, I think that is something that's really exacerbated this story, that kind of, that hypocrisy.
Also, just leave it.
I know.
Like, you know,
the photo evidence was particularly pathetic, I have to say.
I think when she said that to House Bazaar, he should have just said absolutely nothing publicly, just written to her and said, I fucked up, sorry.
For me, the second layer in this story that I think taps into such an important ongoing conversation we're having in the news, in culture and in politics is this notion of the truth.
Mm.
I don't know Moby, which probably goes without saying, so I can't talk with any authority on the details of his character. But the thing I found worrying about his claims is that as I read them, I really did get a strong feeling that he believed them to be the truth. And increasingly, actually, I'm realising that when people give accounts of things, particularly online or in a public forum or published, most of the time they really do think that they're real. I think it's rare that someone writes something knowing it as a lie in that space. So the interesting question is, how can two people have such conflicting accounts of the same event? And this is totally unsurprising in relation to men and women and sexual dynamics and intention. As we've seen in the wake of the Me Too movement, we live in a culture that regularly allows men to believe that manipulation, persuasion, coercion, or just plain abuse is seduction, romance, courtship, or passion. That's something that was examined so well in Rosie Price's book, What Red Was, which we discussed a couple of weeks ago on The High Low.
Yeah, you're right. It was absolutely explored brilliantly. There's a subjectivity to that truth that you speak of, that what's true for one person won't be true to the other. But there's also an objectivity to it, in that a simple bit of fact-checking would have revealed that Natalie was 18, not 20. It's both baffling and irresponsible not to fact check. There's been scandal this week on that front because Naomi Wolf forgot to fact check for her new book. It's a complete oddity to me in this contestable age. And I'm not saying, by the way, that Natalie Portman was wrong to contest. What I mean is, it's strange to me that people wouldn't think in this day and age you have to fact check. And yet it does seem to be common. I mean, you know, both these books are in the news in the last week for having got facts wrong.
I think the other problem is that Moby, like so many men over the last couple of years in this period of sort of collective reckoning, refuses to see his behaviour or story as part of a historic problem between men and women. The historic problem is something I'm sure he cares passionately about in conversation or in theory, but his relationship with Natalie Portman, you can tell he thinks, was about two clear-headed, clear-eyed, consenting and communicative adult individuals that exists in a realm of history completely separate to the one that we're trying to dissect now, and within that seek retribution. And actually, I think a lot of that delusion is due to this nice guy misogyny thing, which means that that deep-rooted, inherited, often historic sexism can hide in a man who is so ostensibly and vocally woke. Beyond it being a passion, it's a part of his defining identity. I think this is why people have got so riled by this story being about Moby specifically, because it's so representative of a form of activism that exists now, where the talking and the declaring and the campaigning and the donating, which I must say as a side note, is incredibly admirable and no one is taking that away from him, but that cannot be more important than our quiet, unseen behaviour in our everyday personal lives and personal relationships, and how we treat people firsthand when it's not on record and no one is looking.
Moby isn't a Ryan Adams or a Harvey Weinstein, but he made this something to unpick when he refused to accept culpability and responsibility and instead got angry with a woman he'd known when she was 18. It's just strange.
Awa Madawi wrote a brilliant piece for The Guardian entitled "Moby's Treatment of Natalie Portman is a Masterclass in Nice Guy Misogyny." After all, Moby doesn't present as a scary predator. He looks non-threatening, he's a vegan, he's politically progressive, he's called out artists like Eminem for being misogynistic. But while Moby might not spout obviously misogynistic lyrics, he's obviously no feminist. He dismisses Portman's version of events, for example, as a gossip piece. Clearly, you can't take a woman's recollection seriously. It's just brainless gossip. In his memoir, Moby also frames his first interaction with Portman in a way which seems designed to make her a teenager seems predatory. Recounting their first encounter, he writes, "I was a bald binge drinker and Natalie Portman was a beautiful movie star, but here she was in my dressing room flirting with me. I was 33 and she was 20, but this was her world. Poor little man-child, you're supposed to think. He was entrapped by a young vixen. She may have been significantly younger, but she had all the power. It was Moby he was taking advantage of. He was just trying to save animals and help stop humans from destroying the only home we have. And then Natalie Portman seduced him. Shame on her, you're supposed to think. Shame on her. You know what's really a shame? The fact that guys like Moby put more effort into seeming woke than they do listening to women. What's really a shame is that a guy like Moby can dedicate years of his life to promoting veganism, but still treats women like they're nothing more than a piece of meat."
Barbara Ellen said that he was mere woke vegan putty in her hands, which made me laugh.
Twitter has been awash the last week with comments on the story. Roxanne Gay wrote, "Men sure love projecting a lot of nonsense onto Natalie Portman. Seems exhausting for her and gross. And the most pathetic thing about Moby's continued insistence that he and Portman dated is how he keeps sharing pictures of them where she looks like she's trying to blink 'save me' while smiling politely, like bro. And he's held on to this for 20 years, so clearly his ego is massive. If only he respected women the way he respects animals, we might get somewhere with this." At Karina B wrote, "This Moby guy thinking he dated Natalie Portman in 1999 because he has a bunch of pictures of him awkwardly, awkwardly putting his arm around her is like the female experience in one story." Alison Siegel tweeted, "Moby got me paranoid, so I'm reaching out to everyone I consider an ex with a screen grab of a text that says only, 'Remember when we dated?' And the reply is simple, 'Yes.' I have to say, and this is in no way me sympathising with Moby or letting him off the hook or comparing my experiences with him, but this did remind me abstractly of just how much my teenage life was characterised by me telling people about a boy I had kissed or held hands with or messaged or even spoken to be met with a very quick and vehement denial on their side of even knowing who I was."
That's the thing. In its essence, it really could just be a massive misunderstanding, but it's how he dealt with it afterwards that was so indicative of it not very likely not being a one-off misunderstanding, of this very likely being a character trait or an outlook upon life and upon women. I think
I think a lot
of people will have a Moby experience. That doesn't make it okay, although there is something sort of sensational about seeing it played out at A-lister
it's
level.
It's so good.
Sort of A-lister level cat person. And it's important to critique it while still keeping it in its context. But like you say, Dolly, it reminds us all of previous times. I also do want to say, and I know everyone won't agree with this, and that's fine, because I'm actually just speaking about my own personal experience. 18 is so young. I feel uncomfortable looking back at when I was 18, I went on dates with men in their late 20s. I don't feel comfortable with that, and I don't care if other people think that's okay. Looking back at how it was and how I was then, I don't actually think that it was appropriate. I was like fresh out of an all-girls Catholic boarding school. I was so wet behind the ears, and some of those situations of the dating, like, they make me feel really like creeped out. And that's the thing. Moby chose to write about a situation that Natalie clearly didn't think was okay, had never been okay, and he might not have known that, and he hasn't seen her in 20 years,
yeah.
But ask her how she feels about it now before you write about it and cause both the internet and your own ego to have a meltdown, because some women might feel at 18, like you were saying, let's not take away their agency, yeah, that they can be in a relationship with a 35-year-old man and the power balance is completely equal. I don't feel that when I look back at my dating history. Natalie Portman clearly didn't feel that. She clearly doesn't feel like they even dated, to be honest. That's a whole different story. But it's a quagmire, and one that definitely needs to be clarified before you write a memoir about it. So note to self, Dolly, if you're planning to write another memoir, make sure you fact check your dating history.
I don't think I can quite bear going having to text everyone who I think I've dated.
Did we date? Yes.
To check they dated me.
Luckily, I don't remember anything, so I'm in blissful ignorance, and in my head, I've only dated like two people, so it's absolutely fine.
I look forward to the memoir.
Thank you very much for listening to The Hilo. You can rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. It helps other people find us and helps boost us in the charts. You can email us, thehiloshow@gmail.com, or tweet us @thehiloshow. Bye-bye.
Bye.